there will be more commercial activity in the city of Detroit. It's been a challenge to stay on top of all of it, candidly, but we're glad to hear this. Meijer is adding a second location in the city of Detroit. The retailer was in the news last July when it opened its first location in the city on Woodward Avenue. The Detroit News reports a second location is going in at the site of the old Redford High School on Grand River on the city's west side. They break ground on Monday. Welcome back to WKAR's Current State, Mid-Michigan's meeting place for the informed, the caring, and the curious. Later this hour, learn about Michigan's role in the Stormy Cromer, the unique winter hat with the ear flaps that is just so distinctive. We'll check in with a company in the UP that manufactures Stormy Cromers. How perfect is that? Neighbors in Action also coming up later this hour. 2020 Girls is an organization trying to get more girls interested in STEM subjects. We're down to fewer than 6 weeks before Michigan primary elections. Here to update some of the races and other stories as well, we're rejoined by Michigan Public Radio Network Managing Editor Rick Pluta. Hi, Rick.
Good morning, Mark.
The 8th District candidates have had a few debates and public appearances now. How is the contest between Republicans Mike Bishop and Tom McMillan unfolding?
Well, actually, there was even another candidate forum last night in Howell.
I
was not at it. I don't want to pretend that I was, but there was plenty of coverage of it. And it played out about the way this race has been playing out, although maybe even a little bit more civilly than a lot of the exchanges that we've seen so far, that like a lot of Republican primaries, that the battle to be the Republican nominee to replace Congressman Mike Bishop, who's retiring, has largely been a race
Rogers.
To the right. I'm sorry, Mike Rogers. Mike Bishop is one of the people
candidates
running.
Yes.
Thanks. Yes, and it's a race to the right, as primaries, Republican primaries often are. It's sort of ironic that Mike Bishop is the former state Senate majority leader who was sort of the bete noire to Democratic Governor Jennifer Granholm when she was in office, but Bishop's opponent, State Representative Tom McMillan, is using the few instances of cooperation and deal making between the two of them as sort of the wedge against Bishop. So he, you know, goes back to the 2007 budget debacle and things like that. And Bishop counters with all of these instances of McMillan who praising what Bishop was doing in the state Senate, being sort of the firewall against Granholm and the Democrats at that point. There's really not a whole lot of policy differences, you know, between them. You know, what we're seeing in as the debates play out, they're both, you know, opposed to the Affordable Care Act, which a Republican candidate basically has to be if they hope to win a primary. They have some subtle differences on what they would do. Both of them apparently came out last night and basically in favor of privatizing the Veterans Administration and finding some alternative to providing healthcare services to veterans, which would be, you know, a pretty, you know, classic Republican position on an issue like that.
Has it become personal between these two? You alluded to the fact that it's been fairly civil so far.
The forum last night was apparently pretty civil, but they're both trying to take each other down a peg, and Mike Bishop or Mike Rogers has endorsed Mike Bishop, saying that he would be sort of the more credible congressman. I mean, what we're seeing here, and this is playing out in a few races in some respects, is Republican primary voters are kind of being asked to make a choice between having a classic bring home the bacon legislator, someone who will go to Congress and work with adversaries, compromise, and make deals for the benefit of the district, usually measured in terms of dollars coming back from D.C. compared to dollars going out, versus a more of ideological, you know, congressman, someone who's going to take, principled partisan positions on, big national issues and things, you know, dealing with security and privacy and taxes.
Is it fair to compare? Is that the dynamic in play in West Michigan between Justin Amash and Brian Ellis?
It is, and it is fair to make the comparison. As a matter of fact, Tom McMillan has called Amash, and they briefly served together in the State House of Representatives, sort of his role model for what a congressman would look like, for what kind of a congressman he would be. And Amash is kind of a controversial Republican. He's part of the libertarian wing of the party that he votes sometimes. Well, you know, for example, that he has made at least one, maybe two votes on abortion related issues that lost him the right to life endorsement, though he is basically, you know, an anti-abortion Republican. And basically he made some votes on some defunding Planned Parenthood bills. He voted against them because he thought that they should be more broadly applied. So it was a principled vote on that. And Amash is actually, he's not well loved within the Michigan Republican Conference, the members of Congress from Michigan who go there. And there is even a congressman, a Republican congressman from California, who has donated to the Ellis campaign. And really, you know, giving a campaign donation to the primary opponent of someone in your conference is considered rather uncricket in congressional circles.
We're talking with Michigan Public Radio Network managing editor Rick Pluta about primary contests so far, congressional primary contests primarily. Where does this Republican drama, the establishment versus Tea Party drama, if you will, where does that leave Michigan Democrats generally?
Well, they are, you know, this is a tough calendar for Democrats, that we're in the midterm elections of a Democratic president's second term in office. Obama's approval ratings are not good. And in these midterms, Republican voters are more likely to get out than Democratic voters just generally. It's one of the reasons why, even though Democrats tend to prevail in these federal elections, and why Democrats keep winning the presidential elections in Michigan, that in these midterms, we keep electing Republican governors, secretaries of state, and attorneys general statewide. And so they're sort of looking at this and hoping that, in the case of the 8th Congressional District, for example, that Tom McMillan is the nominee, because they think it would be easier to run a candidate in the general election against someone who is further to the right, or perceived as being further to the right.
Could Tea Party candidates do better in general? I mean, the memory of the defeat of Congressman Eric Cantor, I think, is still fresh enough on everybody's mind. Could Tea Party candidates do better in general elections than a lot of people think?
Well, you know, it's every election, including the Cantor election, including, you know, the 8th Congressional District, including the Amash Ellis race, that there are so many variables. Predicting political races can be a lot like predicting the economy, where, you know what an economist does. An economist predicts predicts a result, and then explains why he or she is wrong. that the conventional wisdom is that in a primary, a Republican runs to the right and a Democrat runs to the left, and then in the general, they tack to the center. And I mean, what the Cantor race did was it altered the narrative from establishment beating back Tea Party challenges to, hey, sometimes Tea Partiers can still win in this environment, and certainly in a Republican primary, that's the case. Districts are drawn right now, and Michigan is one of the most telling examples of that, to be a very, very partisan. That we have districts that are very Republican, and we have districts that are very Democratic, and very few that, you know, really fall into the competitive category. And so that means that, you know, one, that the winner of the primary probably is the winner of the general election, and to win the primary, it helps to be further to the right or further to the left, depending on what district you're in, as opposed to closer to the center.
Let's not overlook the 8th District Democratic candidates. There mm-hmm. are more Democrats than Republicans here. Talk to us about Schertzing, Grettenberger, Darga, and Jeffrey Hank.
Well, originally, Grettenberger, am I saying the name right?
Grettenberger.
Grettenberger. Thank you. Thanks for rescuing me. Ms. Grettenberger is a college professor, and she was the only one out there getting ready to run a campaign against Mike Rogers. And then Rogers announced he was retiring, and so these other people jumped in. Ken Darga, former state demographer, he's running as an economically conservative Democrat. He dealt himself a pretty serious blow early on when he declared himself a pro-life Democrat, which in mid-Michigan is not the way to win a Democratic primary. Mm. And he's actually even gone during the primary and, you know, made his economic presentation to Tea Party groups. And of course, Tea Partiers aren't going to vote in the Democratic primary, especially when we have a competitive Republican primary and one of their own, in the race. So he's not just tactically, he's not doing himself many favors. Eric Schertzing is the Ingham County treasurer, and he was sort of brought in by Democrats kind of at close to the last minute because they felt he was a more competitive candidate than the others in the race. And if we see a situation where, you know, like we saw in the 11th congressional district a couple years ago when Congressman Thad McCotter imploded, that they wanted to be ready with a competitive Democrat, should somehow the 8th, which is a Republican district, turn into the race. And there's also an attorney, Jeffrey Hank, who's running as kind of a centrist Democrat as well.
Are any Democrats worried about Mark Schauer's coattails not being long enough?
Yes. That right now in this election, we'll hear a lot of discussion about persuading voters, but the big question is whether Democrats can persuade their own voters to get out and vote in similar numbers as they do in presidential elections, as they did for Barack Obama in the last election. And that's basically the game. It's going to all turn on Democratic turnout and whether or not they get out and vote, because we know that Republicans will very likely turn out, and there are concerns that Mark Schauer is not the person to convince those Democrats to get out and vote, and that's the selling job that he has to do to his party's base.
MERS News reported yesterday, Rick, that a handful mm-hmm. of county Republican parties in Michigan are cutting back on the number of delegates that would represent them at the party convention later this summer. They report that Ingham County, for one, is trimming about 80 slots, going from 467 to about 380 openings. What's going on here?
Well, on the one hand, there are thousands and thousands and thousands of precinct delegate positions in the state, and they are actually on the August primary ballot, even though a lot of people aren't even aware of it. And most of the time they just go vacant. And so these county parties, these local parties are saying that basically it's delegate management. You know, people can still run for them. There just aren't going to be as many out there. The sub story though to that is that a lot of this is about Governor Snyder, establishment Republicans, and convention management, especially when it comes to ensuring that Lieutenant Governor Brian Kelly gets put back on the ballot, that the Lieutenant Governor, like the Attorney General, like the Secretary of State, like the MSU Board of Trustees, and a lot of these other positions, they don't run in the August primary like the candidates for governor do, that they are named at party conventions by delegates who are selected at county conventions by local party officials and precinct delegates. And the team Snyder Kelly has been putting on a big effort to recruit precinct delegates to avoid some of the Wild West shows that we've had in recent years that saw Republican National Committee members from Michigan broomed out and replaced, that the state party chair Bobby Shostak barely hung on to his job based on a challenge from a Tea Party challenger. And so they are trying to take control of the mechanics of the state Republican Party to avoid those sort of big protest conventions.
We will take 1 minute to inform our listeners that you will be the chief interviewer of Democratic gubernatorial candidate Mark Schauer in an interview that will originate here from WKAR in East Lansing. That is set for Friday, July 11th. We will be taking phone calls from around the state. We'll be getting questions from listeners. You will be the moderator. We'll remind everybody that happens.
I will be sitting in the seat Bayshore, and I hope I just hope I'm up to it.
You will not have any problem. I can promise everyone that. That's Friday, July 11th. Michigan Public Radio Network Managing Editor Rick Pluta. Thanks, Rick.
Oh, my pleasure, Mark.
Current state on 90.5 WKAR. I'm Mark Bayshore. Throughout the Great Lakes region, there are many wonderful biking and hiking and kayaking trails. Imagine if all these pathways were connected into a giant international trekking system, into a Great Lakes coastal trail. Dave Lemberg hopes to make the multimodal trail a reality. Dave works in the geography department at Western Michigan University, and Dave's the organizer of the Great Lakes Coastal Trail Conference. Dave, welcome to Current State.
Thank you.
The aim is to create an international bike, hike, and paddle route. What does that look like?
Well, I think it looks like really what's already here. I would add drive, because Great Lakes Circle Tours, the road and highway system around the lakes are certainly a major part of this. What we're looking at are existing roadways around the lakes. The Circle Tours have been in existence since the 1980s. And if you link them all together and add the two sides of the St. Lawrence River down to the downstream ferry, that comes out to about 7,000 miles if you wanted to take a nice leisurely drive around the Great Lakes St. Lawrence system. In addition to that, we're looking at sea kayaking routes where essentially, again, the path is already there. People have been paddling around the lakes for thousands of years. And really what we're looking at is mapping the access points around the lakes, mapping the trails, adding shoreline infrastructure to make it easier for people to get on and off the lake. And we've already done this in Lake Michigan. and there are efforts on Lake Huron, Lake Superior, and the area in Ontario. And parallel to the efforts on the sea kayaking routes, the U.S. bike route system has got bike routes either established or planned around the shore of Lake Michigan. For example, U.S. Bike Route 35 already exists from New Buffalo up the shore of Lake Michigan to the Straits of Mackinac. And
this is primarily, Dave, then, an exercise in connectivity. It's connecting a lot of what's already out there.
Connecting what's already out there and then adding in and creating what's not using pretty much existing infrastructure.
Hmm. You recently held a conference where the most stakeholders who could make the trail a reality had the chance to meet. What were some of the takeaways from the conference?
I think the major takeaways are that a lot of people are doing a lot of good work kind of in their own area, and this conference got people together to talk about how we can link up some of these efforts, and then also thinking about how we could potentially market them.
Was this the first time? Was this the first time everybody was in the same room and on the same page?
Well, it was the first time that everybody was in the same room looking at this particular objective. We had a similar conference in November 2012, focused specifically on Lake Michigan. I've been working with people on a Lake Michigan sea kayak route, and we got a grant from the Department of Environmental Quality Coastal Zone Management Group here in Michigan to host a conference focused on trails around Lake Michigan, because the U.S. bike route system, we've been doing similar things on the bike routes. We already have the Lake Michigan Circle Tour. We got everybody together. Good things happened. We got there was a funding program at the Coastal Zone Management Group after the conference, focused specifically on sea kayak route planning, which is just finishing up, and a lot of good groups have been putting the other projects on Lake Michigan, Lake Huron, St. Clair, Lake Erie. So much of Michigan has been, and I left out Superior as well. So that was a positive thing. I think there's been more people looking at potentials for keeping up with the circle tours, which have exist on the road and mm-hmm. on the website, but not so much in terms of preventive maintenance, replacing signs and so forth. This new conference, or most recent conference, was again funded by the Coastal Zone Management Group, and they wanted a larger scope. So we invited everybody, including the Canadians, who we're quite enthusiastic about it. The Canadians have been doing a lot of good work on extending bicycle routes along the North Shore and extending kayak routes on Lake Superior and Lake Huron especially.
Dave Lemberg is our guest here on Current State. Dave is an organizer of the Great Lakes Coastal Trail Conference. He's trying to unite thousands of miles of biking, driving, hiking, and paddling routes into one massive network of trails across the upper Midwest, the Great Lakes, and the Northeast as well, including Canada and the United States. Can you think of any other trails in the U.S. that resemble the trail that you're hoping to create?
Yeah, in the United States, I think the best example would be the Mississippi Valley Trail. So you have kayak routes along on the Mississippi River. You have heritage byways driving on both sides of the river, and you have bike routes along the river as well.
So there is a template out there.
Yeah, I think really the best examples are outside the country in Europe. The Europeans have got an amazing bike route system.
You've experienced that firsthand, correct?
Yes. I originally looked at this. I did my first sabbatical. I had a one-month exchange at the University of Passau in, on the German-Austrian border. I was looking, going there to look at kayak tourism on the Danube River, but what I found was some amazing bicycle tourism where people start out in Passau and they bike along towpaths on the Danube River. It's all downhill. The average age of the bike tourists is probably about 60, though certainly younger people participate as well.
They all have, downhill. I kind of like the sounds of that.
It makes it a whole lot easier.
Yeah.
So people have services that transport their luggage from guest house to guest house. You're pedaling through wine regions, visiting castles, and then you end up in Vienna, or now you can go beyond to Budapest, and then you put your bike on the train and go back.
What's next, Dave?
I think what's next is that we have to digest all of the experiences, conversations, presentations, and so forth that we had at the conference, and then kind of talk among ourselves on the networks that they're developing to start linking some of these efforts together.
Dave Lemberg is a geography professor at Western Michigan University, and it's an exciting idea and organizer of the Great Lakes Coastal Trail Conference. Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
You're tuned to Current State on 90.5 WKAR. Thanks for joining us. Follow us on Twitter at KAR Current State. While many of us are enjoying summer after this year's long, harsh winter, others are using the season to prepare for the coming cold. In the UP, in Ironwood, Michigan, workers are relentlessly stitching a winter cap, the Stormy Cromer, and Current State's Emmanuel Berry spoke with Stormy Cromer CEO Bob Jackart about the heritage behind the hat.
So for those who don't know what a Stormy Cromer looks like, could you give us a description?
It's a wool winter hat that was created to look like a baseball hat with ear flaps. And the ear flaps still work to this day. It was created in 1903 by a man named Stormy Cromer, who invented it, or actually patented the way the ear flaps work out of necessity to keep his ears warm on the railroad engines.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit more about Stormy Cromer and who he was. His name was actually George, and he was born in Wisconsin, right?
Yes. And so when we bought the company, we purchased it because a lot of the business was in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan, and so we all knew what a Stormy Cromer hat was. In fact, before we bought it, it was actually a Cromer cap, so they didn't use the name Stormy. And so after we purchased it, the Cromer family actually was in an appreciative mode and thanked us for keeping Uncle Stormy's name alive. And so we got to know who he was a little better by the family members, and we found out that his name was Stormy because he had a very violent temper, not because he made a hat for stormy weather. We found out that he didn't like to work, and so he had to ask his future father-in-law three times for his daughter's hand in marriage. And the first two times he didn't have a job, and the future father-in-law said, "You get a job and you can marry my daughter." And so he worked for the railroad reluctantly, but his whole life and thoughts were around baseball.
And so he creates this hat. The hat is kind of a co-creation between him and his wife?
Correct. Yep, she put ear flaps on a baseball hat, and he went back to the railroad yard. The way we understand it is he went back to the railroad yard with that hat, and somebody said, "Geez, where'd you get that? I'd like one." And the next week he came back with a dozen, and then it just kind of grew from there. And it became very essentially located in Wisconsin for quite a while, and it became the hat of the railroad people. In fact, when you look at the top of the hat, it's where the six sections of a hat come together, and they actually call themselves, railroad people call themselves six-pointers because of the six points that come together on the top of the Stormy Cromer Railroad hat. And, and so it just kind of plunked along, small business, year after year after year after year, without much velocity per year, but the hat didn't wear out, so there, every year you put out a couple thousand hats, and you end up with a whole bunch of hats after 98 years of doing that. There's hats all over the place with lots of stories. And
so the hat was made in Wisconsin, and as you mentioned, you ended up taking over the company. Why? Why did you decide to pick up that Stormy Cromer mantle?
We were in the sewing business and trying to make it work in Ironwood. And so our mantra was that we will sew a variety of things as long as we can keep the business in the United States and here in Ironwood in the UP. And so I owned a Stormy Cromer hat, and many people did, and I've got a picture of my grandfather wearing a Stormy Cromer hat. And so the day the local dealer came to me and said, can you believe they quit making the Stormy Cromer hats? I called in an order, and they said they stopped making them. I said, let's do something about it. Get me the phone number, and I'll buy the darn company. And it was a very small business when I bought it, and it was very easy to finance and those and all of that that goes with it. It was a very easy transaction. Actually, you did the whole thing without any legal help. We, two men, wrote up an agreement, and we bought the company and brought it back to Ironwood. My plan was that, it was a small number of hats, so my plan was that I could make the hats any time during the year and help keep people working. So if you didn't have anything to do, I'd say go over there and make hats. And we'd just make the year's worth of hats in a month or so and have them ready and then sell them. So that was the initial plan.
Because there are such, you know, as you mentioned, strong personal ties to this hat, I imagine that you've witnessed how important it is to a lot of people. Can you think of a story or some stories that kind of exemplify people's bonds with the Cromer?
There are so many, we don't have enough time, but I'll grab a few.
Thank you.
I picked up the phone one day with a friend that I knew from far away. We did some business together many years ago, and he said, I just want you to know that I just bought a brand new Stormy Cromer hat, put it on my father, kissed his forehead, and closed the casket. We have a picture of 10-minute-old Charlie. And 10-minute-old Charlie is being held by his father with a blue hospital gown on, and they both have hats on. Charlie's got a hat on, and his dad does. And Charlie is a fifth-generation hat wearer in that family. So we bought a hat that five generations in one family wears. We bought a hat company that the dad was so well known that with his hat on that the family wanted him to wear one in his casket. We have over 40 people at least that have told us that they've done that. I hang around a restaurant, that go to the same restaurant every Friday. The owner called me one day and said, are you going to be in tonight? And I said, yep. And he said, somebody wants to meet you. Heard you hang around here. So I'm sitting at my table, and over to me comes a 6'9", 300-pound man that's about 70 years old, and he takes the Stormy Cromer hat off and humbly asks me if I would autograph it. And I smile, and I ask for a Sharpie, and the bartender gives me a Sharpie. And while I'm signing, he says, I played in the 1959 Rose Bowl for the Wisconsin Badgers and got drafted by the Dallas Cowboys and played for them in 60 through 65. And I have an important place in life, and I've had a great life, and I don't chase signatures. I only have two, Bob Hope's and yours.
What an honor.
Yeah. So here I am, little Bob from Ironwood, all excited that I'm in this same thing with Bob Hope. And, I mean, there are so many stories, you just cannot believe it. I mean, the people, postcards, Christmas cards, with the whole family out cutting the tree, all wearing Stormy Cromer hats.
Why do you think people have such a strong attachment to a hat?
It is the most challenging question that about this business. And in fact, to this day, we're on our third marketing company. We have a great marketing company out of Minneapolis helping us. They cannot put their finger on it. The passion behind our brand is so strong. It's my 101 explanation is you become who you really are when you put a hat on. And I've always said, whenever I see someone wearing a hat, they've got a sixth grade smile on their face. And it's that time before you had to worry about, you know, you are who you are. You smile, you know, you smile one way when you're in a business setting and you have to be whoever you are, and you smile another way when you're with your family. But when you're all by yourself, it's something about how it brings you back to who you really are. And we have not been able to describe it. Another thing that's been unusual about this is you can go anywhere. Anybody listening to this can go up to someone wearing a Stormy Cromer hat and say nice hat to them, and you will have a friend. I mean, I've never met anybody that didn't want to talk about the hat on their head if they had a Stormy Cromer hat on. And you'd never do that with looking at a brand on someone's coat and saying nice whatever coat or nice mittens or whatever. But you can do that with Stormy Cromer.
I mean, it clearly has made a mark here in the upper Midwest. How are you trying to take it beyond its current geography and kind of share and spread that tradition?
Well, as we just kind of learn, there's little pockets all over America that we're watching. How do they develop? For example, Lower Michigan really didn't know Stormy Cromer when we bought it. I mean, it really was a Wisconsin UP hat. Lower Michigan embraced it like crazy. I mean, it's just been phenomenal what happened. If you go to Montana, the ranchers call it a Montana hat. It's called the Montana hat. They wear a cowboy hat in the summer and a Stormy Cromer in the winter, and they call it a Montana hat. That happened all on its own. We've got a really hip store in downtown Boston that sells them like crazy, so the hipsters are grabbing onto it. And it's one person at a time. The word of mouth on this product is just really special. I mean, what's going on is just amazing. But we still have pockets that are, for example, Pennsylvania is the largest hunting license selling state in America. And we have very little concentration there, or we have a lot more to go there. If we could put the same concentration in Pennsylvania as we have in Lower Michigan, we would be happy as could be. It's a little bit of a task with the small budget we have. It's mainly happening with word of mouth and somebody moving to a certain town. Of course, then all of a sudden it ends up showing up on that new show called Fargo. The main character's been wearing a hat the whole time.
Oh, really? Show.
And Jeff Daniels wears one in all of his concerts. They show up on TV every once in a while, so that all then the buzz happens. And we sponsored the U.S. men's and women's ski jumping team this year, which ended up being really good for us. They talked about the hat during the telecast of the Olympic trials, and that was really good for us. We sold a ton of hats and gave a bunch of money back to the U.S. men's and women's ski jumping teams.
As you said, you guys do most of your production in Ironwood, Michigan. Why is it important for you to produce product there, produce it here in Michigan in Ironwood?
When I was younger and growing up in this town, I looked around at the business community and was in awe of anybody that had an influence on this community. Never in my life did I dream that I could have an influence on this community. And the fact that I can now is so special to me. Not only do we have the ability to give jobs here, but we also now have people coming from all over the Midwest. And if you look at our map out in the front of the retail store with the push pins and where you came from, we have them coming all over the country. And some people have come from Europe to tour our factory. So imagine someone that didn't think he'd ever have the stature of a business leader in the community. And then all of a sudden you're in a restaurant or out getting gas and a hotel owner comes to you and says, 8 people stayed in my hotel last night, and the only reason they're in Ironwood is because they're taking your tour tomorrow. Thank you. And so our little town needs everything it can get, and I love being part of being positive influence on the community. It's just a very, very special feeling.
Well, it's been an absolute pleasure speaking with you, and glad that you took the time to share a little bit of history and tell us about your product.
Well, I really appreciate you reaching out to us.
Bob Jeckhart is the CEO of Stormy Cromer.
It's Wednesday and time for our Neighbors in Action segment on Current State, where we feature people and organizations working to make our community a better place. Today we feature 2020 Girls, a Lansing-based program that aims to grow the next generation of professional women in science, technology, engineering, and math by introducing young girls to the wonders of robotics, game design, and lots more. Here to tell us more about the 2020 Girls program is Kirk Riley. Kirk's executive director of the Lansing-based Information Technology Empowerment Center. Hi,
right.
Kirk.
Hi, Mark.
Michelle Jennings is the Mid-Michigan K-12 chairperson at the Michigan Council of Women in Technology. Welcome, Michelle.
Good morning.
Also with us, Catherine Van Zwall of Lansing, whose daughter participates in the 2020 Girls program. Welcome, Catherine.
Hello.
Michelle, tell us a little more about the basics of the 2020 Girls Club. How does it work?
The 2020 Girls Club, our goal is to train at least 100 middle school girls, and we covered robotics, mobile app designs, and programming. And the club atmosphere to have all girls together and collaborate and team build together.
That's 100 a year, or
overall,
100. How often do you want to get 100 girls through the program?
Per year. We'll go with per year.
Okay.
What as it sits right now, the goal is to expand it, and we are in the process of expanding it. But the initial project is for 100 girls.
And is there significance to 2020?
It's simply saying that these girls are being prepared for careers in 2020 and beyond. They're right at that age when they're going to be going into college and entering careers around 2020.
And each of you represent different organizations. Michelle, what did your organization, Mid-Michigan the Council of Women in Technology, what exactly do you bring to this partnership?
The MCWT, we are an organization of volunteers, and our goal is to inspire women to advance and remain in Michigan's technology community. We're a diverse IT workforce is a vital part of Michigan's transformation, and we strive to engage and retain female professionals here.
Okay, and iTech, Kirk, is about what?
Well, iTech is all about preparing kids, boys or girls, for these kinds of classes and careers. So classes in technology, in math. iTech stands for the IT Empowerment Center. So our focus is obviously information technology. That means programming, but it means use of technology in any field, and training kids for those kinds of classes and careers.
Catherine, why did you decide to enroll your daughter in the program?
She came home from school one day and was very excited about this flyer that she had for a girls' club only after school. I think it was maybe six sessions. Is that right? Okay. After school on Wednesdays, and she just said it has to do with science and computers, and they would stay after school for girls, and they could just do all these programs, and she wasn't exactly sure what it was, but she said it sounded really exciting, and it had to do with computers and science, and so I signed her up, and then she would come home after school and tell me about it, and she just had a blast.
But it just connected with her.
Yeah, it did, and she was more excited because only girls could do it, and all her friends wanted to do it, and she does like science. She's still at that age where she's still enjoying it, and so she really wanted to do it. I wasn't really sure what it was going to be at that point, but I know she was excited about it.
Do you two feel that girls lose interest in science at some point?
Absolutely.
What's going on there? Why is that?
Sure. There's a sense that it's for boys, and that sense mostly comes from sort of the culture around them within the school. Catherine's point about she's still interested. If we can get boys or girls in those middle school and pre-middle school years still learning in science and math, then we're not going to lose it. Michelle, with her work at MCWT, I think can speak especially to this issue of why girls tend to pull back from those careers.
Michelle, what's your perspective on this?
For example, when we covered the Lego robotics portion on that, it's with Legos. Girls don't tend to play with Legos when they're little. By having all girls club and the girls working together collaboratively, they were able to build and think about gear ratios and create a robot instead of what tends to happen when we have males in the room is sometimes the boys will take over because they're more familiar with the robots and the Legos. And so the girls working together were able to build their robots, and then they ended up programming them.
Catherine, is there a lot of technology in your home? I mean, was your daughter exposed? I assume she was exposed to the internet and computers and maybe some Apple devices or what?
Yeah, I'd say, I mean, she has a laptop and we don't have an iPad, but she does have the laptop and she uses the internet, things like that. She doesn't have Legos and she's never really played with Legos, but she was very excited about that part of the program. And I have to say, with the Legos, those aren't ordinary Legos that they use to change your program.
Always good to add.
Yeah. So she really enjoyed that
part
of it.
Legos from the latest Michael Bay movie. Basically
yeah, those are pretty extreme. But as far as technology, yeah, I mean, we do. I think we have like an average amount of technology, and she knows how to use that.
What age group are you trying to connect with here?
Primarily 9 to 13-year-olds.
Okay.
We will go a little bit older than that, but it's that age where the drop-off is going to occur, and we want to sort of get ahead of that drop-off.
And you've been at this how long, Michelle?
With MCWT?
The 2020 program.
Oh, we just launched it this year.
Oh, okay.
Just this school year, and we started
January.
January. We just launched this year and started the clubs and hope to continue on with that. I mean,
are you connecting with people? I mean, is it resonating with the people you're talking with it about?
Absolutely. It's resonating in my work at every level, whether it's parents and kids, teachers, schools, but also the IT community locally. We have a lot of volunteers who come into the class as instructors or as assistants because they too see that the only way that we're going to, you know, change this dynamic of not having women in IT is to work with these kids. It's a wonderful volunteering opportunity, right, to be in the classroom and see the kids get excited about this.
Well, it's also, I mean, I've heard many times that in our area and many areas of the country, IT jobs are going unfilled. So
right.
I suppose the more people, boys and girls, that we
right.
can that we can might be able to steer in that direction, the better. What kind of outreach do you do, Michelle?
We had with MCWT, females would volunteer and come each week into the class to talk about what they were doing in the IT profession. So they would talk to the girls about a professional area that they worked in. And we participated basically with Lansing School District. We teamed up with Lansing School District to offer the clubs with them and gave them flyers. We gave two presentations to principals and middle school principals at Lansing School District, and then some of the schools were interested, and we launched the clubs at those schools.
You want to spread it throughout the area, or you're going to focus on Lansing, do you think?
We absolutely want to spread it. We're actively looking for funding to do just that. It's a model that will work at any number of locations. Let me add, Mark, one item on the technology in the home.
Sure.
That's a great starting point, but what kids don't learn in that is how to look under the hood. We like to say that as much as looking under the hood of a car, you understand what's in there. And by doing robotics and by doing programming, you sort of understand what sits behind that. Is, you know, if you're going to the internet, what's on that page? What code is on that page that allows that web page to display? So we are, in a very real way, teaching in an IT way, teaching these girls how to look under the hood and participate in those things.
You know, you get them involved in drones. I'll bet you that's a huge. I don't know if you've given that any thought, but that is such an intriguing topic.
That.
What changes have you noticed in your daughter? And I realize the program doesn't go back that far, but I mean, she's way into it here some months into the program?
Yeah, I mean, they did it for the 6 weeks. And but I did notice, like what you were talking about, is she started noticing or she started paying attention to what goes into these projects. So like when she's watching TV and things like that, she's talking about like, oh, you know, that's digital and they do this by computers. And she's starting to think about different, you know, different things that she could do in life. You know, like when I was a kid, and I'm probably dating myself, it's like, okay, you know, you could be a nurse, you could be a teacher, you know, be a doctor. And she's starting to think of like, oh, maybe I want to be an engineer or a computer programmer, things like that.
How about that?
Yeah, there's just different, you know, different things in life that, you know, she's thinking about that it just broadens her horizons and, you know, in that way. And she's just thinking about different ideas in life.
New paradigm. Where does your funding come from, Michelle?
Kirk, do you want to take that question?
Yeah, absolutely. The Women's Leadership Council is part of the United Way, and the Women's Leadership Council has a big priority with working with at-risk girls and empowering them in any number of ways. And they had a grant opportunity last year, and that's where the initial funding comes from. We also, there's an organization called 100 Women Who Care, and we've been funded by them as well for 2020 girls. So a number of organizations that are dedicated, you know, you can see by who they are, that are dedicated to women and girls.
Volunteer opportunities here?
Absolutely.
How does an interested person reach out to you about a volunteer opportunity?
Sure. Just go to itechlansing.org and click on volunteer. It's that simple.
iTechLansing.org. Click on volunteer. Kirk Riley is the executive director of the Information Technology Empowerment Center based in Lansing. Michelle Jennings is the Mid-Michigan K-12 chairperson at the Michigan Council of Women in Technology. And Catherine Van Zwall is a Lansing parent whose daughter is part of the 2020 Girls Program. Thank you one and all for joining us.
Thank you.
We could always use more nominations, and we know there are people and organizations out there doing great work. We need to find out about them. Please help us out. Tweet us suggestions for Neighbors in Action at KAR Current State, or send us an email, currentstate@wkar.org. Put Neighbors in Action in the subject line. Tell us why you think they should be featured. Coming up tomorrow on Current State, we hear from Canada's new Consul General of the proposed on the proposed bridge. Also, we'll look at a new method MSU researchers have developed to track cocaine. That and more Thursday on Current State. Thanks for joining us. It's been Current State on 90.5 WKAR.